Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus on Albany. My guest today is Assemblyman John McDonald. And Assemblyman McDonald is going to assess the legislative session that just ended a week ago. And he's going to talk about what he feels was accomplished. So, Assemblyman, do you think it was a productive session?
Yes, Cynthia. When we look at the totality from the beginning of January to the end of June, and really this year was really the end of June, I think overall it was a very productive session on many fronts. And as always, as much as we tend to forget what was accomplished, we tend to forget what was left and not addressed. But it was overall, I think, a good session. Obviously, the budget always monopolizes most of the agenda and most of the time, and, of course, all the resources. And the budget this year was probably as strong as it's ever been and really moved some agendas forward. But we did also get some good things done towards the end of this legislative session.
The beginning of the session and the end of the session really highlighted the problems between the lawmakers and the governor. You know, at the beginning with his tour of going around the state for the state of the state, and at the end calling legislators back. Do you think the relationship between the governor and the legislature is still pretty hostile?
No, I don't see it as hostile by any stretch of the imagination. I think a lot of people like to fan that fire, and I get that. There is always, no matter what form of government, an underlying tension between the executive and the legislative body. You know, whether it's at the local level of my hometown of Cohoes or Albany, right up to the county level, and definitely at the state level. What is different here is that the executive, the governor, does have a lot of authority, can and really truly has, as Teddy Roosevelt put it, the bully pulpit. And this governor is very good at grabbing that pulpit and utilizing it to his advantage and also the advantage of New Yorkers. The legislature, I think the beginning of the year, the governor did take a different tact for a variety of different reasons. And personally, doesn't bother me. At the end of the day, it doesn't change my service to my constituents, doesn't change the legislative agenda. He chose to do something different in year seven. And you know what? That's fine. Variety is the spice of life. The calling back at the end of the session was interesting, and you know, my thoughts on that is, quite honestly, I think we could have done more during the last remaining month of session as opposed to letting it ride itself out. And, you know, that being said, you know, we came back, we got things done in one day in the Assembly, 2 days in the Senate, and now we're off and running.
So, A lot of the stuff that you say was productive, the average person couldn't see it, and they kind of said this was a boring session, nothing's going on. So from your perspective, can you highlight the five most important things that were passed this session?
Well, there's more than five, to be honest with you. I guess I have to try to figure out what's important, and I'll speak primarily through my constituent's eyes, not through I can't speak for those in Brooklyn or Bronx, because everyone has something different. Mm-hmm. And I should preface my comments that, you know, sometimes a lack of drama, which is equated to your terminology of boring, a lack of drama is good. We don't need drama. We need results. We need productivity. We need, for example, this $2.5 billion housing program, which is going to address housing from all different levels, from the homelessness that is beguiling New York City and even here in the Capital Region, to providing safe, clean, affordable housing for those who are either intellectually disabled or those who are senior citizens. You know, housing still continues to be an ongoing crisis, and we approved over $2.5 billion to address that. It could be the $2 billion that we approved in this budget, bipartisan manner, of infrastructure repair, water and sewer lines, and all that goes into that, you know, whether it's water sources, whatever it may be. That is an important priority. It could be the additional $1 billion in additional resources to K-12 education or pre-K-12 education, as we are past the days of worrying about the gap elimination adjustment, which was true cuts to education, to actually providing targeted resources to our most challenging school districts, be it urban, be it rural, or even those in the suburban areas, to really provide the proper resources. Right then and there, there's three large fiscal items, but also items that really impact everyone's daily lives. There was a lot of energy and discussion this year about the Excelsior program, the college program, which for some people is going to be a great opportunity. My concern still lies with many of the very long-term and productive private colleges here in the Capital Region, as I call them, the three S's, St. Rose, Siena, and Sage, who go out of their way to make sure every individual has an opportunity for education. They were kind of left behind in this process, but it's something that we will continue to work on in that aspect. And then finally, here's number five, and this is only from the eyes of John McDonald, not from the whole Assembly or the Senate. You know, I think in the ongoing heroin and opioid crisis, I think one of the programs that came out that was in the governor's budget that we supported was these 10 urgent access centers that will be created throughout the state of New York to be there 24/7, 365 days of the year, for those individuals who make that decision that they need help. Far too often, people are at that point of when they need help, when they're in a hospital emergency room. It's the worst place to be trying to find drug treatment. That's the place to go to be brought back to life, but it's the worst place to start to redirect your life. That the hospital ERs continue to be burdened and really a crisis center. So by having these urgent access centers strategically located in areas where there is a high preponderance of individuals with addiction, we are actually bringing it to the community to help people navigate the insurance issues, to navigate the proper choice, because not, you know, people are not looking at drug addiction as a disease. They're looking at it as a social issue, and that's not appropriate. It's the way we originally looked at AIDS back 30 years ago. We need to look at it as a medical disease. We need to look at what would you do if somebody came in hypertension? You wouldn't put them in a facility for 30 days. You try to help them control their lifestyle to live a life on their own, because otherwise they become dependent on government. And that's something that no one truly wants to do, is to be dependent upon government. So there's five quick ones off the top of my head.
Okay. You're a pharmacist as well as a lawmaker. And, you know, you mentioned something very important just now, the heroin addiction, the opioid addiction. Why has that mushroomed into such a big problem over the past few years?
You know, it's an interesting point, and to be honest with you, it's starting to get the attention the last 3 or 4 years, but it's been building for the last 15. And you can point back to a time where we took a different approach in the healthcare world, where people were, back 20 years ago, living their life in excruciating pain. Doctors were afraid to prescribe controlled substances. And healthcare, not pharma. Everyone likes to blame pharma. And, you know, like anything else, there's plenty of fingers to point, plenty of people to point out that are a problem. But healthcare said, wait a minute, we can't have people living in chronic pain and excruciating pain. So this led to a change in prescribing habits. Now we're trying to stop that, because we're finding out that because of that and also the other aspect, improved access to health insurance, medication all of a sudden did become more affordable for substances like oxycodone, hydrocodone. And once people are on it for 3 or 4 days, they get addicted. And then guess what? We put a clamp on the supply of opioids, and what did people do? They went for the illegal opioid. They went for heroin. Now, heroin's worse because drug dealers don't go to pharmacy colleges. They don't, by any stretch of the imagination, follow any of the FDA manufacturing practices. Drug dealers are only out there to basically make their living. And they don't. All they want to do is satisfy their customers. So if Cynthia is getting by with 8 bags of heroin and says, I need more, well, I'll give her 9 or 10. Or what I'll do is I'll give her a super potent dose of fentanyl. And the problem with heroin versus crack or cocaine is an excitatory stimulant. You start sweating, your heart is beating the whole nine yards. You know when you've reached your threshold. The problem with heroin and opioids is it sedates you, it relaxes you, and all of a sudden you don't realize that your respiratory system is now depressed, and that's what's causing these deaths. And it's going to take a long time to address this issue. I'm not saying that happily. I'm saying it realistically.
Do you think there's a more influx of heroin than there has been in the past?
I think it's more readily available. That's for sure. Where it's coming from, that's something the sheriff or the attorney general will be better to answer. But I know it's coming in from Vermont. I know it's coming up from the city, and I know it's coming in from Mexico. That I do know.
Now, you talked a little bit about the Excelsior program. That will provide what Bernie Sanders talked about during the campaign, tuition-free mm-hmm. college, correct? So
tuition-free college,
you know,
at public systems, at the SUNY and CUNY system, but it's only as the payer of last resort. You have to exhaust all avenues. It's not a very simple just show up and it's a free ride. And it only includes the education tuition. It does not include the living conditions.
Right. So if the stars line up properly for a college student and they do get they do qualify for the Excelsior program, that's just tuition. So that's not saying that the college won't increase their housing, their meals,
right,
and other
right
things. So my friend Alan, who is working on this student loan debt crisis, says that young people will be just as indebted, if not more, even if this program was enacted. What do you say about that?
Well, I think, you know, the intention was good. I think the impact is going to be questionable. I think for some individuals, they'll see an appreciable impact. But, you know, to your point, you know, there's different ways to make money. And, you know, my concern is multiple. I worry about the quality of the education. I personally, and this is where I depart from my party and my caucus, we have failed the education system from kindergarten to 12th grade already by underfunding it. We are failing our communities by not supporting the state's share of community college tuition. We still do not meet our 33 cents for every dollar for education. And if not, if we had done that over the years, might we have made students more college and career ready? Wouldn't it be wiser to be bringing college into the high school classroom when we have these young men and young women at in a contained setting they're you know, required basically to attend, as opposed to, and allow them to maybe knock 1 or 2 years of college out while they're in high school. In other words, recognize the high achievers, recognize those who may not even dream of going to college, and provide them that opportunity. I think that would have been the wiser choice. before going out there and funding a program that is probably going to have a difference, a positive difference for some, but not for many.
Now, you talked about the education situation. And when you guys were called back for the couple of days this past week, the issue was mayoral control of the city schools in New York. Explain what that is.
Well, it started about probably 15 years ago. There was a departure from what was the practice then, where there used to be community school boards sprinkled all throughout New York City. And, you know, from what people have said, I don't know if I can't say this to be factual, but basically, you know, it's nice to have local control like we have in upstate New York, but I guess there was a lot of political corruption going on as well, and that was a challenge. And it wasn't really in the best interest of the children. So by giving the mayor control of the school board and appointments and the appointment of the commissioner versus having to coordinate with the borough presidents, It presented a great opportunity to kind of at least provide from a top level some unification and some consistency. And, you know, when Mike Bloomberg was mayor, he had like 7 or 8 years where he was in control. And then when de Blasio started, Mayor de Blasio started, the legislature took different tacks. And, you know, admittedly, the Senate, it was not supportive. The governor has had questions, but said that we need to have mayoral control. And even in the Assembly, we have some members that are not happy with the mayoral control. But the bottom line is it's set to expire June 30th, and if it didn't get addressed, then they would have started the deconstruction process of the current and moved to an older model, which mostly everybody, the Senate, the Assembly, and the Senate all agree, wasn't the model we wanted to go back to. So it was a matter of the length of the term. And that was tied to the every 2 year county sales tax extenders, which was going to expire in November. And if they were not, that additional 1% of sales tax, if that was not extended, we would have seen a significant financial hit to those counties that required it, which is about 53 in total. Thankfully, we came to an agreement. We extended sales tax now for 3 years versus additional 2, and we extended mayoral control for 2 years, which is good. It's the way, you know, it's compromise, and not everybody won and not everybody lost.
You live in the Capital District, and I'm sure you know, you watch what's happening in Albany. And the people in Albany are facing a possible $23 million deficit. So what would you say? Would you like to have mayoral control of the schools to close the budget gap here in Albany? Would you like to see mayoral control of the schools?
Well, let's make sure we keep things separate here. The mayor does not have control of the city school district, nor is the mayor or any mayor that I know of interested in having control of the school district. In regards to the $23 million figure that's being floated out there, and I think it's erroneous in some aspects, I think, you know, that is putting some things together, and don't get me wrong, it is not wine and roses here by any stretch of the imagination in the city of Albany, but I think we are making some significant progress in regards to addressing the city's concerns, the financial concerns. Through no fault of anybody's, the city has always had a $12, $13, $14 million budget gap. You know, and fortunately, they were able to work off a large fund balance. Mayor Jennings was able to borrow money from the future to help plug those gaps because it was that desperate. Mayor Sheen has taken the first year or two the similar approach by borrowing from the future to pay for the current. But this past year, Mayor Sheen, myself, Pat Fahey, Neil Breslin, made a very forceful pitch for the fact that there truly is a disparity in the city of Albany compared to other parts of upstate New York. And I'm talking about Syracuse, Rochester, Buffalo, Yonkers. And obviously that, you know, the mayor has done the right thing. She went to the fiscal restructuring board, laid all the cards on the table, said, here's what I'm doing. I'm going to be able to cut $2 or $3 million, and it's going to be a recurring savings year over year over year, which is now starting to happen in the last year or two, and will continue to grow that savings. At the same token, there is still this $12.5 million cut, which has been this $12.5 million gap, which has been a consistent argument for the last 20 years that the city was not being treated fairly compared to others. So, you know, I have not looked closely at this $23 million statement for deficit. You know, I'm not a mayor anymore, so I work with what the mayor and the state controller tell me. And, yes, you can make the argument for structural deficits. You can make that argument for almost any community throughout New York State. I can tell you most, I don't want to bore you with the details, but hardly any local governments use GASB amortization for their debt. If you did that, you would see everybody into the $20, $30, $40 million in debt. So don't get me wrong. We need work to do. The mayor's, I think, put forward a solid plan in Albany. This is a major victory for the residents of the city of Albany this year. That once again, little, if any, tax increase, and a $12.5 million grant from the state with no strings attached. And, you know, as you know, recently announced, there was $6 million surplus due to a couple of one-time occurrences. And at the same token, there have also been prescribed savings that actually came true that was committed to by the mayor and the common council. So, you know, it's kind of funny. I always find it interesting when the $6 million surplus came out, people were almost booing it. And I'm like, I don't get this. You guys aren't voting. You're supposed to be on the same team, Team Albany, you know, and there are people out there deriding it. And I'm like, okay, you guys, I will, you know, move on, because at the end of the day, we all know, whether it's a city or whether it's a household, you can't operate in a deficit situation. It's not good for those who live there.
Let's dwell a little bit about infrastructure. How bad is infrastructure in New York State? Are the bridges crumbling? Are the roads? Do they need work? What about mass transit?
Yeah. So all across all the spectrums, whether it's water and sewer systems, whether it's water sources, whether it's roads, bridges, and mass transit, there's obviously a huge documented need. I mean, you know, here in the capital region, there are plenty of roads and bridges that you know, are in, they're not dangerous, but if left unattended, are a problem. And that's why the legislature and the governor have wisely taken some of these large bank settlements over the years that number into billions and have set it aside to help put more money in the streets. You know, most people don't know that every local community has seen a significant increase in their CHIPS aid, which helps with road paving, and that we are moving more projects through the pipeline in regards to bridge repair. I mean, you see it now. One just has to drive. You drive right now, today, you cannot connect from Cohoes to Waterford because we're rebuilding the bridge. And we're closed on the weekends during the month of July to tie in this new bridge, which, sure, if left unattended for a couple more years, probably would have failed. But that was failing 15 years ago when I was mayor. And it just took a while to get the money in place. In North Greenbush, we're replacing the Route 150 bridge. Why? Because it was going to fail in a couple years. So we're getting stuff done. We're moving along. But, you know, this is not nirvana. There's a lot of what we see. We can see above ground. What's really scary is what's underground. And water and sewer lines are aged. They are just like gas lines are aged. And they do need to be replaced over time. And the problem with underground is you just never know when it's going to go. You can take a guess. You can look at statistics and analyze, okay, we've had five breaks in 2 years in this one-quarter-mile stretch of line. Maybe we should be looking at this in a more productive manner. And that's what good municipalities are doing. But there's a great demand. I mean, just water and sewer alone, the state controller has come out with estimates of up to $80 billion. Well, we put $2.5 billion in this year, which is good. But it's just, you know, it's going to be used wisely, and it's going to be, you know, I think it's going to help meet a lot of our environmental goals and public safety goals and public health goals. But let's not kid ourselves. We've got a long way to go.
It's one crisis after the other in the state legislature. Wouldn't you agree?
I look at them as challenges, Cynthia.
Okay.
A crisis is unfortunately when some doctor walks into a hospital and starts shooting and killing people like happened yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
That's a crisis.
Right.
You know, that's when,
what's
you know, at the same token. What's that?
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
A crisis is when young men and young women or older adults are found with needles in their arms in downtown communities because they die of an overdose. That's a crisis. And that's what we've put in hundreds of millions of dollars of resources and will continue to do so. But at the same token, you know, we've got to educate the community, that's the public at large, and we've got to dare to be different on certain things.
How do you feel about the renaming of the Tappan Zee Bridge?
So I have no issue with renaming the Tappan Zee Bridge. I mean, the irony is, you know, down in that area, you know, on either side of the bridge, that's a big issue for them. Up here, upstate New York, we're going to keep calling it what you started off with it. You started calling it the Tappan Zee Bridge because that's how we know it. No disrespect to former Governor Wilson, but did you know that that was named after Malcolm Wilson until this story started to erupt? Maybe you and about three others in the upstate area. Not many people did. So,
John, I'm originally from the city, and I've never heard it called the other
Malcolm
than
Wilson
the Tappan Zee Bridge.
So, you know, listen, I in all fairness to the family, one of the things that many of us in the assembly request that there be some other kind of recognition and accommodation to remember Governor Wilson, who I think only served for a year. In the same token, I have no problem with Mario Cuomo was a good governor. You know, maybe I look at that from the eyes of a teenager because I was a teenager when he was governor, but he was a strong orator. You know, he was a very strong spokesperson. He was a great speech writer and actually delivered speeches. Yeah, he was probably a little more liberal than I would be, to be honest with you. But same token, he served this country and this state very, very well. Had a large impact on upstate New York. So I don't have an issue with it at all, to be honest with you. I think a lot of people tend to dwell on that. I don't. I think I spend more time, literally we spent a small amount of time on the naming of the bridge. Our main focus gets back to the core essentials I hear about every day from my constituents: housing, education, food, health care, jobs, and taxes. That's what I focus on.
Okay. Now, Behara is no longer the prosecutor in New York State. Do you see an appreciable difference in ethics? And do you think because he's not around anymore that things will go back to the way it used to be?
I think Preet Bharara did a great job. He really had some major high-profile cases which were impactful. I think what's been lost along this process, and I've seen it in various iterations in my five short years in the Assembly, is that legislators now more than ever before are very keenly aware of their actions. You know, what you don't see, you know, back to, you know, a boring session. You know, you don't see the fact that legislators spend a couple days in ethics training and going through various scenarios. Because the reality is many members of the public come to their legislators expecting they're going to get their wishes granted. And that's not always possible, sad to say. And therefore, we have to work within the confines of the law. And just like anybody else, sometimes we forget what the law is. And if you don't believe me, why don't we go up on the Northway? We'll stand out at exit 7 and watch a few people going by at 75 miles an hour. It's natural. I don't mean to make light of it. The reality is, you know, there are people who have bad character that get elected into office. I can't control that. I really can't. I've got bills to promote greater examination of those who are running for office, who are in office. I firmly believe our disclosure reports should be posted on our state websites and our campaign websites so that people know, for example, that if they're going to vote for a John McDonald who's running for the New York State Assembly, that he's a practicing pharmacist. They should know that. You'd be surprised what people don't know. And, you know, I'm not trying to lay this at the feet of the public, but the reality is this. No point was made any greater to me than my first day in the New York State Assembly. I'm sitting in the chamber enjoying the splendor and the beautiful light shining through on a cold January day. And I look to my right, and there's my friend Steve Otis from Rye, who I'd known for years as mayor. And then to our other right, God rest his soul, was Vita Lopez, who was overwhelmingly reelected at a time when the newspapers were filled every day with his activities. Now, Steve nor I did not elect him. He was elected by the people, and the people have a responsibility. Plain and simple.
Thank you. Enjoy your summer. And enjoy your fall, and we can talk again in January when you guys reconvene in January. Do you think there'll be the standard state of the state, or do you think they'll be scattered throughout the state?
You know, I have no idea what January is going to bring. I have no idea what July 2nd is going to bring. I got to get to that first. We'll see, Cynthia.
Thank you so much for being on Focus on Albany. Have a great summer. And maybe I'll see you in the park on Tuesday. You've been listening to Assembly John McDonald. If you like the show, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, download on your smartphone, subscribe to iTunes. If you have a comment about the show, hashtag Focus on Albany. And be sure to listen to WCAA 107.3. The brand new radio station in Albany. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Have a great 4th of July, Assemblyman.
You too. Thank you.